Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill, and this job is fun.
It is fun.
It's just fun. We get to go to great places and act like people care about us.
Yeah.
And they seem to like to have us there, and today's pretty special. We went to the top of the American Life Building where they're creating a 17,000 square foot green
thing. Okay, because you know I don't have any sort of 9-to-5 jobs.
No.
And I think now that the roof at American Life has this fabulous, you know, succulent display, I could potentially work in an office building that looks down on it. I mean, just think about if you got to look at that every day from your high rise office. You know, she's really kind of provided a service not only for her own building, hopefully, that's the plan, in terms of installing a green roof, but Nana Lambton, but all the people that get to enjoy it from even the Galt House, if you're a guest there. So it's pretty cool.
And once you see one, you say, why not two and three and four, and let's green the roofs of every...
Quite frankly, it delighted me beyond my imagination.
Yeah.
It's really fabulous. So yes, we're going to talk with Nana Lambton and also Mark Worms, who's the director of Bernheim. Collaboration with various people, of course, but they're the two main components to getting this green roof installed on the American Life rooftop there on Main Street in downtown Louisville. So we'll bring that to you in the second part of the show. But before that, we're also going to learn a little bit about entomology solutions.
Yeah, it's a woman named Blair Lino Helvey, and she grew up loving bugs and being fascinated by bugs, and she's developed a company here in Louisville where you can buy bugs and we'll have to figure out how they do it, praying mantis and the beneficial bugs that will prey on the non-beneficial bugs if they know which one is which.
Well, and that's the thing. But like everybody has their specific favorite meal, right?
Yeah.
So that's what entomologists do. They know these things. And Blair's put this to kind of an entrepreneurial spirit in terms of encouraging people to use beneficial insects instead of chemicals in the garden.
Exactly. That's what it is. And then we'll talk to her about how you keep the bugs home and how do you get them back year after year and all the things that might come with raising bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Beneficial bugs.
Oh, beneficial bugs.
Yes.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's coming up today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, I have long expressed lust for a dove tree.
Uh-huh.
You know, Davidia.
Sure.
I had a poem about it. I've dreamed about it. I saw one at Winterthur like 8 or 10 years ago in full bloom or full cry, as I like to say. I've got one.
And don't Carla Sue and Brad Broker have one?
I think they do, and I think there's one at UDell also, somebody told me.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a new cultivar called Sonoma.
Oh.
Blooms in the second year.
Oh.
Oh, my God. I came out of the box, and I had tears in my
eyes. So you have it in your possession?
I have it, and it had blooms on it when I got it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I paid as much for this plant as I got from my first week's pay out of college.
Did you really?
Yes. Like 100.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is an obsession.
It's like $105, including shipping from a nursery in Oregon. And
well, that's not too bad for a blooming dove tree.
Not for a life's lust like this. So I'm excited about it, and I've got it in a very careful place away from the lawnmower blades, and I talk to it daily. And I'm just
pumped. That could put it at a disadvantage. You might want to pull back on that a little bit.
Right. That's true. Go away, Mr. Hill. Leave me alone. Well, Bob's got a dove tree.
And, yay.
I'm going to have you come out and see it.
I think that's been, you know, my quest to get chickens. I think the dove tree, so maybe we've reached some sort of
our lives are over.
Benchmark
somehow. Well, I didn't want to wait 10 years for it to bloom, which is what the problem has been.
Yeah.
This one blooms the second year.
All right.
Sonoma.
See, you should have gotten it 10 years ago.
I didn't know it was around.
Okay.
How about the wish estate? What's going on out there?
Okay. There's nothing that says we can't change our mind, right?
I hope not.
And maybe it's a good sign because you're continuing to think about things, right?
It's a sign of maturity and evolution.
Right. And paying attention to what's happening.
So you're gonna correct a mistake here, is what you're
I'm going to rethink something or suggest that we all rethink it or that I've rethought it.
Okay.
So last week we had a question from, because I thought it was so clever. And I thought, surely I can't be right that this is just a fabulous idea, right?
Yeah.
But a woman named Veronica was wondering if it was a pretty good idea to plant white clover around her blueberry bushes as sort of like a living mulch kind of thing. And it would also feed the bumblebees and such and honeybees. And I'm like, well, it's sounds like a pretty, you know, clever idea to me.
You're a sort of a strong advocate
right.
for that.
Right. Other than if we go through drought, you'll definitely have to irrigate.
Right.
So I've planted cover crops in my vegetable beds, and I pull it out and turn them under right before I plant, right? It's great living mulch, so weeds don't get in there before I start to plant what I really want. So I was pulling up some hairy vetch the other day.
I know him.
Yeah.
And hairy vetch, an old buddy of mine.
And I pulled it up, and then I turned the soil with my garden fork.
Yeah.
And it was very dry.
Uh-oh.
So it got, and then I was like, oh no, yeah. Veronica's blueberries. And I thought, you know what? It may be a situation to where the competition would require that you irrigate more often than just during serious times of drought.
Oh,
so I'm kind
of
thinking maybe it's not that good of an idea. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you're a grown-up person to admit this publicly to 50 million listeners.
Well,
across.
I mean, that's gardening, isn't it?
Yes.
We keep learning from our mistakes, and experimenting is fabulous, but sometimes it's not repeated.
The poor plants die from our mistakes.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I'm thinking we need to rethink that. But at the same time, maybe do it around a few, Veronica, and keep us posted as to whether or not it works.
Okay.
You can be our experiment.
Yeah.
All right. Bob, there's some cool things going on around town. The gardening tour season has definitely begun.
Yep. Yeah, one of the best ones. It's the 16th annual Crescent Hill Garden Tour. It'll be on Saturday, June 5th from 9 to 5, rain or shine.
Mm-hmm.
And they say features sites ranging from the formal to the artsy, from gardens designed on a sunny, rocky hillside to a quiet space brimming with shade plants. It is a good tour. 12 different gardens.
Ooh, that's a lot.
That's a bunch, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Tickets available the day of the tour at 205 South Peterson Avenue, or just go on our website and you'll see
where to get your
tickets.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. Also on the very same day, Saturday, June 5th, Blooming Bargetown. It takes place from 9 to 4, and it's 8 private gardens in Bargetown and in Nelson County. Basically, they're having like a garden fair set up at the Extension office, which is at 317 South 3rd Street there in Bargetown. So lots of options to take a look at some good local gardens.
And you may see some bugs, too.
You may indeed. Bugs are good. We get excited about seeing things that aren't perfect, which is, you know, usually bug chewed. But there is a nice balance in nature, and beneficial bugs, if we keep that balance, beneficial bugs can help us control those that aren't so beneficial.
Yeah, and we've got a woman that can tell us all about that. She's Blair Lino Helvey. She's a Louisville Manual High School and University of Kentucky College of Agriculture graduate who, as she explained it, has always had a lifelong passion for insects and other small critters. That interest led her to start a Louisville-based company called Entomology Solutions, which helps homeowners establish colonies of insects and bugs in the home garden and yard that can produce beneficial results without the use of pesticides and chemicals. She's with us today to talk all about that. Blair, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, hello. Thank you.
Let's begin with your kind of your background. You say you grew up loving bugs, and even now you have a 2-year-old son, and you have a pet praying mantis and a Madagascar hissing cockroach in your yard. That truly is a sickness.
Are in my house.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Let's get it straight.
They're in your house.
And there's multiples.
Oh, really?
Multiples, we do.
Where does this come from, do you think? Where'd your love of bugs develop?
Oh, my mother comes from Knox County, Kentucky, and so we would go down there a lot to the farm, and we would collect acorns off the pin oak tree, and she would find ones that had little holes bored into them, and we would open them up and we'd find like a little caterpillar in there.
Uh-huh.
And that's my earliest memory. Or just, you know, running in the cornfields and finding, you know.
And not being freaked out by it, like being delighted by
it. No, I had a sister that's 10 years older than I am, and so her and all her friends would always, you know, mess with me, and that was like my only defense was to put
that
bugs.
That's great.
And I would collect like the blue bottle flies. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know where you find blue bottle flies around like dog heaps. And
yeah.
But I would find dead ones, and I love the colors, like the metallic greens and the blues, and I would make big piles of them in my mom's house.
That kept your sister away too, I would imagine.
Well, I think I was about 6 or 7 the last time we had the periodical cicadas come, the 17-year cicadas,
mm-hmm.
And I would just put them in their beds. And,
uh-huh.
decorate with
That's good ammunition, isn't it?
It is.
That's great. So it's been a clear fascination early on. So when you pursued your higher education, were you able to, you know, really focus on turning that into something a little bit more professional?
No, I actually started as a music performance major.
Did you?
And once I realized there weren't any jobs in that, then I picked something else that there weren't any jobs in either. I actually looked at horticulture, and then when I realized that UK offered entomology, I thought, wow, that's
where you need
to go. That's where I need to go.
Yeah.
So what is a beneficial bug in 25 words or less, if you can?
Well,
or 50, if you like.
Well, let's see. We'll talk about beneficials. Of course, you have your pollinators. You have your bees. You also have your predatory insects, such as praying mantid. And then you have your parasitoids. And parasitoids rely on their host pest to finish out their sexual reproduction.
Mm-hmm. Ah. So, Blair, is there a clear American definition of what qualifies one as a pest? You know what I mean? On the opposite side of being a beneficial? Or is it just something...
Oh, sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like, is one, a pest to one person not necessarily a pest to another person? Is it...
Well, there's some
crops?
People that look at all insects as pests.
This is true. Right.
I have a lot of people tell me that they don't like any insects.
Yeah, which is too bad.
When we're talking about pests and agricultural practices, we're talking about things that feed on crops or things like that.
Okay. So kind of just to focus in on what the beneficial is versus what the pest is.
Absolutely.
I think is a good distinction.
There are over a million insects that have been identified to species level.
Okay.
With another estimated 8 million to be done. Okay. So they're the most diverse group of organisms in the world. Mm-hmm. And 25% is estimated that are beneficial insects.
Okay. So for our purposes, it's anything that consumes an agricultural product before the human consumer can get at it, right? Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. Well, then, how did this lead to Entomology Solutions?
I needed a job. I loved a vegetable garden, flower garden, and I never spray. I never, even if it's a pest, I hate to kill anything.
Sure. Oh.
And every year I have somebody that would call and be like, I don't know what this pest is. Can you identify for me? And then I just thought, well, this could be a service. And then last summer, I kind of just did a sweep with a sweep net in my backyard and just kind of counted out how many beneficials I have. So, I mean, they're naturally there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, and I just kind of did some investigating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the West Coast beneficials are used a lot on farms, greenhouses, home gardens, and it just has not really made its way here.
But people are really interested, I think, more and more today in trying to reinforce a natural balance in the garden as opposed to, you know, freely spraying chemicals and all of that.
Yes and no. Some of the people that I've worked with so far that use chemicals, it's very hard to get growers off chemicals, even if they're not working. And that's what we're seeing a lot of, is that the insect resistance to pesticides.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what do we need to do to lay the groundwork to maintain a good environment to keep beneficials at home?
Well, the first thing is to not use broad-spectrum insecticides.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone tells me that they are using broad-spectrum pesticides, I tell them to quit. And then I ask people, what are you spraying for? What are your problems? And a lot of people don't even know. That's why they use a broad-spectrum pesticide. But for people that are not using them, like your backyard gardener, just getting a patch of flowers that are not sprayed, and that gives a place of refuge and a source of nectar and pollen for your beneficials.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the, what we're talking about, especially with the predator insects, when they're in their adult stage, they like to have pollen and nectar, and that also helps with their egg laying.
Oh, okay.
So
So not just like sucking on some other insect that
is
a pest, you also need a little bit of a diverse...
Yes.
Huh.
They like a little diversity in their diet.
Cool.
So people can call you up and say, hey, come on out, Blair, look at my bugs and give me an inventory of what I got
I
need.
If somebody wants me to come and look at their garden, I'll come in and I'll do a sweep and I'll kind of see what they're growing. And then when I do that sweep, I just kind of see if they have any beneficials.
Mm-hmm.
Usually if people are not spraying, they have them, they just don't see them.
Right.
A lot of these, especially the parasitoid wasps, I mean, they're microscopic. I mean, they're tiny, you know, 1 millimeter.
Mm-hmm. In an average sweep, in a relatively healthy garden, can you give us some specific examples of beneficial insects from those different groups would be found?
You'll find lacewings, green lacewings, brown lacewings, various tiny parasitoid wasps.
Mm-hmm.
Aphidelides, which Aphidelides is an aphid midge. Uh-huh. So it is a fly, but the larvae of that fly is predaceous on aphids.
Okay.
You'll find some little praying mantids and ladybugs. Immature ladybugs look like little black and orange
alligators. I think, yes. Because actually, just I'm glad you brought that up. One year when I was talking to a group, I found some, you know, miniature alligators in the garden right before I was going to do my talk. And I put them in a little jar and I showed it to everybody. And I'm like, if you found this in the garden, what would you do and what would you think? And everybody was like, ooh, kill it. I'm like, no, this is going to be a ladybug. So that's part of the education as
Absolutely.
Well. We have to know what everybody looks like in their various stages.
Absolutely. Wheel bugs. Things like that. Mm-hmm. And they're even, you know, you talk about stink bugs. Well, they're good stink bugs instead of bad stink bugs. Mm-hmm. So it's just
a
identifying
bit of an
from
education.
People. Yes.
Uh-huh.
So the beneficial bugs then don't eat holes in your plants. They only eat other bugs.
No. And if they don't have any food available, then they'll just kind of drift onto your neighbor's house or. Mm-hmm.
But they don't eat plants. They eat other bugs.
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And since what are the targets then? What bugs are the beneficial bugs eating?
Okay, so for example, well, if we're talking about mantids, because a lot of people, when I say beneficial insects, they automatically just think mantids and ladybugs. Well, they're way more beneficial than that.
It's just those are the prettiest, right?
Oh, sure. Well, mantids will pretty much eat anything, including each other.
After sex.
Well, yeah. You know,
and the guy gets eaten, too, is a heck of a
thing.
That happens a lot when you have them in captivity.
Uh-huh.
Usually, if they're out, it's very similar to like human behavior. They do their business and then they run.
I'm leaving the room here.
So they're sort of omnivores, if you will, in the okay, they'll eat lots of different things.
I mean, they
things.
Definitely will eat a lot. They love flies. Mm-hmm. They love crickets. Mm-hmm. But don't be surprised if you see one with a butterfly or something like that.
Too.
Or your syrphid flies.
Mm-hmm.
Syrphid flies are a great beneficial. They actually mimic like a bee, but their larvae are predaceous on aphids also.
Okay. So aphids, definitely one we want somebody to be eating. And a lot of these beneficials will eat aphids.
Lacewings love aphids. Mm-hmm. The Aphidelides, again.
They'll eat beetles and caterpillars and mites and scale. That's an
scale insect.
Yeah.
When we're talking about scale, when people tell me that they have a scale problem, I tell them to take a closer look and see if you have an ant problem. Because insects like the aphid, scale, mealybug, white fly, they all produce the sticky excrement called honeydew.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you can control your ants, then your natural enemies can take control. There is a graduate student at UAK right now who she did a project last summer on calico scale on maple.
Mm-hmm.
And she just put the substance, it's called tanglefoot. It's just like a real sticky kind of a barrier that she put around on burlap sacks that were tied around the trunks of the trees. And just by controlling the ants, she reduced the calico scale by 75%.
So how did she do, I mean, how did the ants help the calico scale?
Well, the ants protect any of these
because
honeydew.
Because they're going to produce honeydew for them, so they protect the scale.
Absolutely. So, and they fight off natural enemies. So if we're talking about aphids, I mean, they actually herd them like cattle. They'll milk them.
Wow.
Man.
Huh.
Okay, so I invite Dr. Blair to my yard and I have all these bad bugs. What are you going to do to fix my problem? Specifically, how do you solve it?
So if we're talking about, okay, for Japanese beetles,
yes.
Mm-hmm. You would need nematodes, microscopic nematodes. And so that's something else. You say nematodes, well, people automatically think of like root knot nematodes, bad nematodes, mm-hmm. but there are lots of good nematodes. The nematodes are actually microscopic worms, and they're called infective nematodes. And what they do is, if they come across the and they're taking care of your soil-dwelling pests.
Okay, so the grub stage of the Japanese beetle before it becomes a beetle.
Yes, flea beetle larvae, flea larvae, codling moths. I mean, there's a whole array of what these nematodes will take care of. And what they do is they enter these grubs, mm-hmm. and then they release a bacteria, and it results in grub death, and then they multiply.
Okay.
Grub death. I just love the sound of
that. So then once they're introduced, they should persist in your soil and help control it. So typically speaking, would we have enough grub larvae to continue to sustain them?
Yes. And there's some, you know, it's just like with any other insect. As soon as we get freezing temperatures, mm-hmm. it's going to kill out a lot of them. So mm-hmm. you'll want to implement with them every year.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these beneficials will overwinter in our climates, and there are quite a few that will not.
Okay. So you just kind of be aware of mm-hmm. what's happening.
Okay, now you brought in to us, and I thank you very much, a cocoon. What do you call a praying mantid egg?
An uwatheca.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Would you spell that for us for 50 points, please?
O-O-T-H-E-C-A.
Okay.
Uwatheca is their little...
That's their little egg case. They just look like little brown marshmallows.
Yeah, they're cool. Okay, so I got this little brown marshmallow thing full of several hundred praying mantis that haven't popped out yet. So what do I do with it, and how will it work?
Well, when the females lay, and they will lay them usually like a boxwood or an evergreen, somewhere where there's a lot of protection, and they lay them on sticks. So basically what you'll do is you'll take like a little piece of string, and you can tie it to the inside of a bush. Or if you want to watch them, just put them in a paper bag or a big jar and just check on it daily.
Mm-hmm. And they'll come out and they're just teeny tiny little things,
oh, they
right?
look like little aliens.
Mm-hmm. And they'll get 6 inches long eventually or
this
longer.
This species, the Chinese mantids, will.
Yeah. Oh. Where did these come from? Did you
some of them I collected.
Cultivate them yourself?
I kind of know where to look, so some of them I found, but we do have a shortage just because of all the rains washed them out.
Okay.
So a lot of them come from a couple of the insectaries that I use out on the West Coast.
Okay, so insectary out on the West Coast, but also beneficials that you may collect here with Kentucky provenance.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So if we broke into your garage at night, it'd be full of these oofer things or whatever, cocoon?
You would find them in my refrigerator.
Okay. How many different species do you have of bugs that are beneficial bugs in your refrigerator?
Right now I have nematodes.
Okay.
I do have nematodes, and I have, I have 100 Uwathecas left.
All right.
And I have 50,000 ladybugs.
All right.
They like ham sandwiches? That's where
now
I keep
my mantids, they will eat honey, and they will eat some cat food.
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of mash it up for them and feed it to
them. Baby a little bit.
Well, another gift you brought in, a beneficial blend of seed mix, which contains alfalfa, baby blue eyes, baby's breath, cereal ryegrass, coriander, common vetch, clover, fennel, mustard, all these kind of things. Would you recommend the gardener just scatter these throughout the vegetable garden or have a little patch off to the side?
I would do a patch that you are definitely not going to spray.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And maybe define it in some sort of way so it doesn't take over the rest of your vegetable patch either, because a lot of these will recede themselves.
And if you don't want them to recede, then you just, just get rid of them before they set.
Yeah, deadhead them, so to speak.
But if you had too many praying mantis in there, they eat all the other beneficials too, perhaps.
They can. They can. But, it's survival of the fittest.
Uh-huh. I know, yeah.
So.
That's the fascinating part.
You may have
this.
500 come out, but you're not going to have 500
right.
Yeah.
live.
So do you recommend people reorder next year some more of these oofery things? Or...
Once you have them, you're probably always going to have them.
Okay.
Yeah.
As long as you maintain good,
sure, and a
good
lot of people,
cultural practices.
Yes,
so
you're
to
not.
Speak.
You're with the mantids. You may not even know that you have them until we get into August, and you see these 6-inch creatures crawling everywhere.
How about diseases? Any evidence that these will work? Bugs can help somehow?
No, but they're definitely there's good bacteria and good fungi to put out on your plants or to feed your soil.
Something else you do is bacteria?
Mm-hmm, I can. Mm-hmm. I do provide some of those. There's a couple products called Defensor and Rhizoboost. And what you do is you make a drench and you feed that into your plant, and that is raising the immune system of your plant.
Mm-hmm. Well, how's it going so far, the business? I mean,
I definitely have some resistance.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I definitely,
I'm sure.
One of the talks I gave for the Louisville Nursery Association, I definitely was heckled a bit.
They didn't boo you off the stage, did they?
They didn't boo me. No, they didn't boo me. Nobody really wanted to get near me because I had this big mantid on my shoulders.
Well, I'm sure it's an uphill battle, but it certainly makes a lot of sense what you're doing.
I mean, when we're talking about switching to biological control, it's definitely slower. You're trying to get your insect colonies established.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not a quick fix. People like to use those sprays and see, bug death right away.
Well, it's a more holistic approach, quite frankly. And a holistic approach means you've got to change your mindset about not just one thing, but a great many different things.
Absolutely.
Well, there's a horrible revelation, horrible story a couple of weeks ago about possible ADD linking with insecticides.
Organophosphates.
Mm-hmm. The phosphates and little kids, along the way, eating fruit from stores.
Yeah.
Someone that I'm working with loves malathion, which is an organophosphate.
Yeah.
And that is, it's hard. It's hard. I think it'd be easier to do interventions and get people off crack than it would to get growers off chemicals. And I understand. I don't fault growers because they're just doing what they know
how
to do.
They're protecting their
absolutely.
Crops.
I mean, that's,
right.
Yes,
sure.
Absolutely.
Sure. But, yeah. It's complicated.
Well, Blair, thanks. It's been fun and very informative.
Thank you.
And I hope it works well for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Blair Liano Helvey is the owner of Entomology Solutions, a company that will bring good bugs to your yard. For more information on Blair or her company, visit our homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we visit one of Louisville's true green roofs atop the American Life Insurance Building. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Let it bug, let it bug, let it bug.
Let it bug, let it bug, let it bug. Let's go find a ladybug. Let it bug, let it bug, let it bug.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill. And what an incredible and joyful experience this is.
I'm quite delighted.
Yeah, here we are on the roof of the American Life Insurance Building. There's 17,000 square feet of green roof around us, and see them in different plants and cacti, even Kentucky cacti up here.
Yep.
And just walking around and seeing this green and looking up and seeing the river, the Humana building, it's almost a life-altering experience.
That's the thing. It's like there's a fabulous long shot view, but then if you look beneath, right beneath your nose, you see this miniature landscape almost. I feel like I'm a giant standing over all these beautiful little sedums. A real green roof, in fact, in Louisville. Nana Lampton is with us today. Nana's the chairman and CEO of American Life Insurance Company of Kentucky. And Mark Worms is also here. We'll speak to him shortly. He's the director of Bernheim Arboretum and Research Forest. We're all gathered here atop the building because of a collaboration that's taken place to get this green roof in place. So Nana, thanks for having us out, for sure.
I'm so happy you came. And the wonderful thing about this is that we had to redo the roof, and it was about 35 years old. We'd finished the building in the early 70s, and I thought, well, if we're going to redo the roof, why don't we do something that will help this whole ecology, this mm-hmm. wonderful river. And to think that we have peregrine falcons and could have bees on top of the building and wonderful flowers growing as we go down the pike. But working with Mark was great.
Yeah. So what possessed you? I know that you have a little bit of a reputation, shall I say, as being somewhat of a conservationist. You've got many farms locally, also in other states. So I know that you are very aware of sort of alternative approaches to things. So in terms of, okay, you have to redo the roof, but you're putting on top of a famous building, in fact. We need to talk a little bit about the significance architecturally of this building. And you're going to put a bunch of plants on there. Are you a little nervous that you might have made a mistake?
I wonder if my shareholders think so, but I think they're in favor. And the wonderful thing about doing the roof was that it becomes part of Doxiata's beautiful plaza in Belvedere that he designed before Mies van der Rohe took the commission. And the reason Mies van der Rohe took the commission was because of the famous landscape architect, Doxiatis.
Okay.
And he knew that he could build a sculpture out of that garden. So this is just a continual effort to build a garden as one.
Yeah.
Give our listeners a sense of how this was accomplished, the engineering and the hiring of the right people to get this done, before we talk to Mark about the actual plants here.
Turner Construction built this building. They were often the builders of Mies' designs. And so Turner kind of took the lead and asked Millennium Park, asked our good friend, the Steinrock Company here in American Metal Roofing here in Louisville, and also worked with people who had mats of sedum all over the country. I think our roof came from many states. And so when we had to redo the roof and the drains and everything, we just went ahead and put in irrigation and hauled up these 2,000-pound bundles of soil.
You mentioned there was a crane park on Main Street for a while, and that was the hardest thing about this project.
It was an expensive part of the project.
Yeah, I think you said it cost $300,000 up front, but when you look at the energy savings over the years, you'll get that back along with just the beauty of the place and the fact you're doing something really good for the community.
I think we should get back about 3/4 of our electric bill for cooling. We're not so sure about heating. It could be half, but we do believe it has benefits.
Are there going to be ways, since this was installed, last fall, are there ways to actually quantitatively track these things so that you can, mark some sort of savings?
we can track it by the bills, and we won't have any trouble with that. We have the wonderful Jones family in this building who are working on 21 Century Park, so we're very interested in helping them be green.
Mm-hmm. Any surprises in doing this when they started doing the actual construction work? Was there something that just, that, uh-oh, this may or may not be better than I thought or worse than I thought?
I thought the interesting part was the soil. It's so small. It's 4 inches deep, and it's porous. I didn't think it would stay put and that a big wind would blow it off, but it really has done well.
So you talked about drainage and those sorts of things. You didn't have to do anything structurally to make the ceiling or the roof sound to hold this. So when we look around at, as we stand atop the roof, we look around at other flat roof surfaces, would you say that most of these older buildings are sound and equipped to hold a sedum green roof?
I would think they'd be plenty strong because the weight of this soil is not so great. Irrigation might be somewhat of an issue, but that can be done with a hose.
Mm-hmm. So as we look to the future, Nana, and we'll talk in detail about the collaboration that's going on with Bernheim. As we look to the future, do you see more potential for the roof here to be an educational experience and perhaps a sort of a showcase to try to get other buildings around in downtown Louisville to adopt the same techniques?
I look across the street and see a couple of garage tops that could benefit from this. Mm-hmm. And also my good friend Mary Mosley might have a wedding site there on top of her flat roof. But I believe this will take place. Mm-hmm. It has to, because we have to have a CO2 eater. And this is what this roof is. It just eats the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, just being here amazed me. I mean, I love the green, and then you look up and see the buildings, but I was able to climb to the very rooftop garden. There's actually two layers here, and I peeked through the top, and I'm eye level with about an acre of sedum, it seemed like. And what an experience that is to
it
be
really
right
is.
There looking at sedum.
Yeah.
It's like a billion trees, and you're just a big old giant out
mm-hmm.
there.
I mean, that's the thing. We talk about the, okay, potential savings in utilities. There's also the CO2 eating ability and the urban heat island effect that people have talked about a great deal to cool our cities a little bit. But there's also just that human response, a delighted response to something that's green and not a gray, ugly roof.
I think people will be very happy, and they already call me daily from up in the towers.
Oh, do they?
Around and say, oh, the roof is looking good today. But the one big effect of it is to control the runoff. The water storm sewers mm-hmm. are less filled now because of this retention of water on the roof.
Okay. Have any UPS pilots checked in yet?
Not yet, but I'm sure they'd be welcome.
All right. Thank you, Nana. It's fabulous. So Mark Worms is here with us as well. Mark is the director of Bernheim Arboretum and Research Forest. And Mark, the collaboration, how is this going to benefit Bernheim, and how does Bernheim help Nana Lampton and her green roof here at American Life?
You can't ask for a better place to have a collaborative project. This roof will act as a seed for Louisville. It will spread green roofs across this city, because what's been shown is the few smaller green roofs that have been done are critical elements. But now suddenly we have a commercial entity that says it's worthwhile to do a green roof. We have a very visible roof looked down by some of the biggest towers in Louisville, all saying, hey, it's a beautiful roof. And then when you add the fact that it's going to have a 30 or 40 year life cycle, it's going to last longer than a traditional roof, it's going to help the air quality and water runoff, and it's going to add beauty and places for wildlife such as birds and butterflies, and it's going to reduce the heat that bounces off into space and creates hot cities. Who could say there's a problem with this? So when Nana Lampton called us and said, hey, I love your project down at Bernheim where you're investigating what plants will work on living roofs, will you come up and do some test beds on our roof? We just said, yes, 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 yes. It was a great opportunity. And again, the reason is because Bernheim has been a green leader for many years, but one of the things Bernheim is committed to is really connecting people with nature and get people involved with what they can do to help the environment. And green roofs are not just about big, giant projects, but those are grand opportunities like this one. Mm-hmm. It's also about what you can do on your garage and on your house and in the community you live in. So this is the beginning of a green revolution.
Okay, Mark, you've got like six different sedums up there and a lot of other native plants. Talk about what sedums you have and how you selected these particular plants for this roof project.
Well, the fun part is that when you start testing green roofs, there are some entrepreneurial businesses out there. And this one is a rolled mat. You buy it almost like a sod. Huh. And those sedums come in. There's about 8 or 10 different varieties. And they range from a little blue spruce that's got this lovely gray-blue color to a sedum that's called red carpet that has this short growth but tends to hold a bright reddish gold and brown all the way through, you know, to many different greens and textures. And so you roll this out on this very mineral-rich soil. Sedums love hot, dry places in the summer and fast-draining places in the winter. And so that's what this roof is. And it's one of the reasons sedums are used coast to coast. Mm-hmm. Bernheim brought in a whole different palette of plants in our test beds. Okay. And what we want to do is broaden that palette that people can use.
So the majority of the roof is this rolled-out sedum mat, if you will. And then you've got three test beds, 12 by 12. Yeah. So explain which each test bed is representing.
Well, we used a 12 by 12 bed because that matches our test beds down at Bernheim,
Okay. Where
we have these tabletop height platforms built like a roof. So you have the rubber matting to prevent water from entering your roof. You have the root protection layer, and then you have a drainage layer, and then finally you have the mineral-rich soil and the plants. And this is built that same way. So in our three beds up here, since the rest of the roof is sedum, we didn't test additional sedums.
Sure.
And sedums are kind of the standard. So what we're testing are some native and ornamental grasses, some prairie grasses in particular. We're testing a group of plants from Kentucky glades.
Okay.
And this is really exciting.
And explain what a glade is to our listeners.
A glade is an area in the forest where you have a limestone outcrop, and then there's thin soils, rocky, gravelly soils over top. And these glades are hot and dry in the summer, and they drain rapidly. And so anything that grows there is really tough. Mm-hmm. And there's one of the neat things is glades are little pockets. They don't occur very widely. And so they're unique habitats with wonderful rare plants in some cases. Mm-hmm. So we thought these were ideal for a rooftop. Mm-hmm. And then the final group are rock garden plants. And the reason is, again, they like that hot, dry, fast draining. And they add a lot of beauty, a lot of color throughout the season. And so we're testing a bunch of rock gardens.
So ultimately, when the test is done, or as you test it, you know, what are you taking note of? What are we trying to figure out? And then, you know, how will it be used?
Well, our wonderful horticulture staff who installed this, bringing things up in buckets, up the elevator, it's a different kind of horticulture. They are up here, and they're measuring the plants. So they're measuring the height and the spread and which ones lived through the winter and which ones didn't. And we'll do this for a 2 or 3 year period. At that point, we'll be able to say, oh, yes, cerastium, snow in summer, does really well on roofs, or no, it died out, or our slender mountain mint has done really fabulously, or rattlesnake master is a great thing. So we'll be able to tell you that these are some possibilities for future roofs. Ideally, when you add Kentucky native plants to a roof, you're also adding all that habitat and feed plants for birds and butterflies. And so you've getting additional ecological benefits.
Yeah, Mark, we might tell our listeners also that although they can't come up here on the roof, they can go to Bernheim and see some of these plots that you've been practicing on down there. And they're open to the public all the time.
Absolutely. And people love it because, as you said, Bob, there's something special about getting eye to eye with these plants. And because we build our beds at tabletop height, you really get a great look at them. And we have people who tell us, oh, man, you know, this is doing great, or that one, you know, the phlox is taking off or whatever. And so we have people who are watching this stuff week by week, just as Nana has people looking down on this roof saying, hey, it's looking great today.
So I remember a student interview several years ago with, is it Snodgrass?
Ed Snodgrass.
Yeah, from, who's a green roof.
The East Coast. He's the big guy.
So if we look at it now, we've had enough time to really evolve, if you will, in terms of technologies and resources. I mean, now you can buy a rollout sedum mat, right?
Yes.
So if I wanted to do something at home, like on the roof of a barn or something that's slanted, mm-hmm. how much would I have to actually change to be ready to put it on a pre-existing farm structure?
Well, you know, what you want to do is make sure that your roof is solid enough, mm-hmm. that it has the structural support. But again, on a gabled roof, sometimes that's a given, because that also distributes the weight a little bit differently.
Okay.
But you know what? This isn't rocket science. A lot of the fun about this is if you're a gardener, there's a lot of ways that you can test some of this stuff yourself. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's one of the things we're doing at Bernheim right now, is we're building a small kiosk with a gabled roof that we'll be testing ferns on, because it's a shady area.
Okay.
And so there's some tough ferns that might be beautiful draping off of a roof. We've got another one going in our children's play garden this summer that will be a combination of three different styles of roofs. And so, you know, it is about having some fun, and it's about taking some steps. On a slanted roof, you have to hold your soil in a little bit. So you might use a soil mat, or you might have cross supports, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Horizontal supports. But really, it's about building pockets that plants can live in.
But the resources are available now because the technology has advanced.
There's some great technologies, and mm-hmm. there's wonderful resources on the mm-hmm. web and around this community. And one of the things we hope is that now that people are seeing these examples of green roofs, that there's going to be some wonderful young entrepreneurs who take off and make this mm-hmm. happen.
And they can assess the list that hopefully you will amass in the next 5 years in terms of what works and doesn't, right?
Absolutely.
He just needs more enthusiasm about this.
I think so.
I'm just kind of
just
boring about
it.
This whole subject.
All right, so Bernheim's a good place to visit if you want to get started and take a look at the green roof. You know, we mustn't forget Nana's rooftop, maybe you only see it if you're flying by in a UPS airplane, but I think all of the people that are in the office buildings around,
sure.
we forget that they get to enjoy it on a regular basis, a daily basis.
Or tourists to Louisville at the Galt House.
That's right. The Galt House
look
gets
right
to enjoy
it. Look right down upon the Belvedere and the green roof here.
Yeah. So definitely it's already far reaching. We appreciate both of you, your efforts, and your time today. Thanks, Nana.
Thank you so much, Denine and Bob.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing everybody go green.
There we go. All right. Nana Lampton is the chairman and CEO of American Life Insurance Company of Kentucky, and Mark Worms is the director of Bernheim Arboretum and Research Forest. They're both a part of a larger collaboration to get more green roofs in downtown Louisville. Thanks to you both. Of course, for more information and photographs, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latinus Wordus of the Weekus. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Well, Miss Wishy, two tree-related questions. One dead and one not so dead.
Well, this is good. Balance. We always want to keep balance.
I'll give you the dead one.
Okay.
It's from Lynn.
Thanks.
A neighbor lost a white oak tree in the storms we had about 2 weeks ago. A tree company came and cut up the tree. They put a lot of the limbs in the chipper and mulched them up. Now my neighbor has a nice pile of chipped up oak. They told me if I wanted some for mulch, I could help myself. My question is, can I use this chipped up fresh wood for mulch? Thank you, Lynn.
I've actually had quite a few discussions with people about this very issue, you know, from arborists to just gardeners. And for so long, don't you remember how, you can't use fresh chips, you're just going to, they'll pull all the nitrogen out of the soil, et cetera, et cetera. And I did it. Okay, here's the experiment thing, back to that.
Uh-oh.
A couple years ago after the ice storm, right?
Yeah.
We had all of our debris that we staged chipped up on site. It was dumped in a pile, and over the course of the next week, Andy and I spread those chips underneath the crab apples coming up the driveway. Because, you know, there's such big tree rings.
Oh, yeah.
It was great use.
I've seen them, yeah.
You know, and all this was fresh, tipped up stuff. And I joked with my arborist consultation people, I'll let you know if all my trees are dead in a year. And they're not, I'm glad to say. So we basically discussed it in terms of any sort of nitrogen pool that the chips may take, you know, from the soil. Mm-hmm. The exchange is going to be such a quick turnover.
Right.
You know what I mean? Where they'll be improving the soil and giving it back to that tree, you know, in short order. So with that said, point is, around woody plants and like trees and shrubs mm-hmm. in your tree ring area, your no-mow zone,
right.
I think chips are great. To put it down in a vegetable garden walkway sort of thing,
right. Okay.
Great. But around herbaceous perennials, that sort of thing, or you know what, I wouldn't, because it's going to be hot and burn the crown of the plant. But woody plants, I think that it's completely reasonable and a good use of and reuse of what you've got.
So it's a semi-equivocation here.
Yeah, woody plants and your tree rings, and it lasts a long time, too.
Oh, I know.
So it's smart in so many sort of sustainable ways.
I've done just that, and as far as I can tell, there's no bad results.
Right. Yeah. You know, so from experience, but just don't get it all hot around a herbaceous
plant. There's so many things like in gardening like that where over the period of time you...
They become myths.
Twice in the same show now, we fessed up to...
Yeah.
Possibly being wrong.
Yeah.
The possibility now.
Yeah.
Just a hint of possibility of being wrong.
Right.
Maybe.
All right, babe. This one's from Marianne.
Yeah.
She has a tulip poplar that she's had in the ground for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she purchased the tree for the yellow blooms in the spring and the fall color.
Right.
The tree is healthy and growing, but the tree blooms are green and there is no fall color, she says. So she thought maybe she didn't have a tulip poplar, but when she looks at images of one, it looks like a tulip poplar. So she's wondering why she doesn't have yellow blooms like the pictures and why there's no fall color.
Well, somebody wrote a book once called Great Expectations. And that's part of the trouble here. I've got a lot of tulip poplars over the years. And, you know, photographs often lie, too, honestly. You see pictures and they're kind of enhanced. Ours have yellow blooms, but they're not really bright yellow blooms.
Kind of greenish, too.
Kind of green
they?
Yellow, yeah. That's what the tulip poplar does.
Uh-huh.
And the fall color depends on the year's kind of a muted yellow.
Mm-hmm.
It's yellow, but it's not a great color. So.
I never really thought they had fabulous fall color to begin with.
No, they don't. And so I'm not, you know, maybe she expected too much,
mm-hmm.
a la Mr. Dickens or something, but. It sounds like what a tulip poplar does to me.
Yeah, and there's variations, too, in terms of the year and probably age and, like, how much sun it gets is kind of a question I have as well. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
All different kinds of things can affect, you know, each tree is an individual, like a human being. But, yeah, expectations, I think, is a fair way to put it.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah.
If you have a stump or a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org. Call us at 502-814-8246, or we're still waiting for our second letter of the century here. Write us a letter at 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Well, Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week sort of buried me this week.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, it did. Unfortunately, I live in a river town, and I know
You know this all too well, don't you?
Yes, I do.
The Latin word of the week this week is inundata, inundatum, or inundatus.
Yeah.
And as you might suspect, it means flooded.
Underwater.
Hence, growing in places liable to flood.
Yeah, New Orleans comes to mind.
It does. So, you'll be well equipped, you know, I mean, if you think about it, you'll be well equipped to not have oxygen for a certain period of time if you're a plant that's going
to
grow in places that typically flood, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So sometimes that means that you might also be good in compacted soils because there's no oxygen in compacted soils either.
Yeah.
It goes both ways. So, for example, sphagnum inundatum.
The water spurge.
Water spurge.
Yeah.
Euphorbia inundata.
The Florida pineland spurge.
Spurge is a theme here.
Yeah, yeah.
Phacelia inundata.
The Plala yellow scorpion weed.
You know, scorpion weed comes up a lot. It may be in contention with all the carrots and that always comes up. So yeah, Phacelia inundata, scorpion weed. How about this one? Rhynchospora. Did I say that right?
You're on your own, kiddo.
Rhynchospora inundata.
The narrow fruit horned beak sedge.
Beak sedge.
Sounds like a bird.
But I mean, really, sedges, spurges, that sort of
thing.
There
is a theme here.
Lindernia dubia variety Inundata.
The old yellow seed false pimpernel.
Yeah.
Another great book.
So if you see Inundata, Inundatum, Inundatus, point is these plants typically grow in places that periodically flood.
Yeah.
So maybe not a bad idea to put them in low areas or, you know, compacted areas that hold water when we get lots of rain at home as well.
Yeah, that could be a follow-up to the scarlet pimpernel, the yellow pimpernel.
Oh, it could be.
Yeah.
Consideration. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We do hope that you join us again next week.
Homegrown is produced by the rarely all-wet Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.